Welcome back to Pax Europiana. In this part, we discuss about EU enlargement history. And this podcast is about the history of the EU enlargement from 25 to 28. Romania, Bulgaria in 2007 and Croatia in 2013. And these are the three countries we will discuss. And also about the attached crisis, the Second Cold War, why we are stuck a bit, the great financial crisis, obviously, of 2008, and also the Second Cold War, which Putin declared in Munich at the Security Conference in 2007, at the 10th of February 2007, and how this all happened and why we are in the situation that since 2013, no new country has joined the European Union, and actually one has left the United Kingdom tragically. So let's sum up and start with this amazing and fantastic year 2004. That was really the climax of European and American cooperation, of European and American power, at least in Eastern Europe. Obviously, never forget the context of the Iraq war and the big divisions in Europe. But at least on this one, on NATO and EU enlargement, there was unity of purpose and it happened. And that was really an amazing year, and we can all be very proud. And it has really helped Europe and obviously is a showcase of institutional reforms which really worked. But of course, it was 10 countries at once in NATO and in EU in two phases. And it has led to a little bit of loss of energy, especially in the German and Austrian elite, but also in some others, yeah, who have then said, okay, we've done our duty. It's anyhow expensive and complicated, and no more. Then, of course, was the issue of Romania and Bulgaria and Croatia. There was some kind of understanding that this is important still strategically, Croatia being a very popular country in Austria and Germany, Romania and Bulgaria being strategically really very important and always have been and always will be at the Black Sea with Turkey and the Russian situation. And so there was some necessity in a way, and there was some consensus later to be developed. But in generally, the whole enlargement was then in this kind of valley of reality that obviously that's very expensive, obviously that's very complicated, and it is also run into a certain kind of, I call it the identity, national identity development of the new countries, which didn't really fancy, at least significant parts of them, to be just neutral member states. And they felt a little bit too less respected in some aspects. That's also true. And there was also this kind of feeling of fatigue, it's called the enlargement fatigue. After 10 new countries and then three more, there was a little bit the feeling of overstretch and overburdening. And obviously, the financial crisis has been also a significant blow to the self-confidence of the European elites and of the Western elites and of the perception of the Western elites of its capacities to do more. And also, obviously, that the massive resistance Putin was able then to deploy from 2007 onwards, culminating in the Bucharest summit and this debacle of that tragic event, that was obviously a very problematic period then for the West. And it has led to the fact that also there was less energy behind the enlargement debate. Additionally, what happened after 2013, especially in the second term of Obama, there was a significant lack of interest of Obama in Eastern European problems. You know, he had other issues to care, and he felt happy with himself. And always this feeling to reset relations in contrast to the Republican Party. The idea was of the Democrats, we just talk nicely to Putin and he will be so fine with us. Obviously, they learned it the hard way, especially Mrs. Clinton, that this is not the way to treat Russia. And she wouldn't do the 2009 reset ever again. I'm confident about it. But okay, it's always this kind of feeling, the megalomania, we just talk nicely to our enemies and then they will be nice people. It has not turned out to be the truth in any of the incidences in the past. Because if the core is hostile, if there is negative hostility there, there cannot be any appeasement because it is just leading to defeat and submission. So we became from 25 to 28 in these years in this very difficult context. And it's obviously also connected with, how can I say, also that the reality of Eastern Europe after occupation, 40 years of Soviet occupation, before World War II destruction, before there was also just in few countries, in the Central European countries, similar development like in Western Europe, in Hungary, for example, in Slovenia, in Poland. Yes, mostly yes, there was in the interwar years and in the before the First World War also similar economic conditions comparable to Germany and to Austria and to Italy. But obviously in Romania and Bulgaria, they never were developed. And it's obviously going to be more complicated also in the remaining countries from ex-Yugoslavia and also Ukraine, where similar levels of development never have existed, and actually a lot of lack of investment and neglect, especially in the south of the Balkans, is of course significant. So also the problems facing the confrontation with Russia and the problems of underdevelopment, we are already absolutely bigger in the remaining countries which are candidates now or should be candidates, like Ukraine, Georgia and Moldova. So objectively, it's also more difficult with the remaining members. And this had led to the kind of negative narrative that Romania was already complicated and not a success and was too early. Because that's always then the narrative which develops out of this situation. When you see it's expensive and it's complicated, then the narrative develops, especially in the richer countries, Germany, now very rich, and France, which never wanted enlargement from the beginning. And then obviously the explanation is it was too early, which is totally ridiculous and absolutely wrong, because when something is complicated, it doesn't get better when you postpone it. Postponement means less transfers, means less opportunities for the country, means more migration, means more internal cooking in a non-working soup, and it doesn't really solve anything, as you see very well in the countries of the Western Balkans, because outside you don't develop very well. Inside the European Union, you develop much better. And the proof is Bulgaria and Romania and Croatia are developing much better. And the remaining things, they don't work so well because we have not developed the European institutions to really be a union of 27 states. Then you can, of course, say we have to wait until we develop them. But if we are not able to get our act together, it doesn't really, it's not very fair to postpone the other countries. So when we don't really develop the necessary European supervision institutions because we don't want to transfer so much power from Germany, from Austria, from France to the EU level to have a European-wide FBI, like we have a very minimal prosecutor office now, but we are not able to have common Frontex, common border police like the US Coast Guard. We are not able to do all this. And then we say, because we are currently under renovation, we close it for the new countries. Anyhow, don't let me get started in this one, because I will make a very specific podcast series about these problems. But I remind on the context. 2004, fantastic. And then was, of course, this EU of 25. We knew there is the promise to get Romania and Bulgaria in 2007. And for this was basically the one major effort Europe United was still able to do. And already our relation with Russia was already much worse because the spillover effects to Ukraine and to Georgia, the revolutions, they were setting all alarm bells up in Russia, because ultimately they were afraid that Ukraine and Georgia, they're really going to join the West as well. And that's what they wanted. And that's what the Americans wanted. But here came the popularity curve of the second Bush term, which was decreasing in Europe, to say the least. And I have to apologize to my American audience in the name of all Austrians and all the people who went to protest in 2006 to the street against George Bush because of the Iraq war, it was really very outrageous, the level of anti-Americanism we have seen against a very good president of America who really did so much for freedom in Europe and who really cared for freedom of Europe and for free Europe. And I really admire him for that. What happened? He then, and let's go into the April 2008 summit of Bucharest. This was a decisive event in world history, and not a good one for many reasons. But let's first celebrate what happened and what really worked. Yeah? This was the NATO membership of Croatia and of Albania. Again, this was, of course, the Americans wanting it because they are the prime security providers in the Balkans and still are to this day and will be for the long term. And Albania and Croatia, obviously, clearly allied to America in the Balkan Wars and before and after. And they were really looking for this honor, for this privilege, for this opportunity to join NATO. And in the case of Croatia, there was some popularity in Germany, and so there was no major resistance towards Croatian membership. And Albania is a wonderful country. I lived 6 years there. I love it. But, you know, it was America carrying Albania into NATO in 2009. And it was Greece blocking Macedonia. That was the first debacle on this Bucharest summit, which has achieved these big achievements, Albania and Croatia in NATO, but it failed Macedonia, and we lost no more than 12 years in a kind of Macedonian crisis all over again. And it was a miracle that it worked so well, even under the Trump presidency. And America has played a significant role to get this done, to get the agreement with Greece and to settle this open question with more North Macedonia. And we can be all so happy that it worked and it was possible at this moment to get this agreement in 2018, the Prespa peace I'm talking about. So we lost 12 years in Bucharest at this tragic summit. And then obviously also George Bush, maybe he was not completely preparing it. Yeah, that's the argument which was often used. It was also that the French and Germans, you know, they felt the decline of American power at the overstretch in Iraq, and also, and they felt the point of revenge towards Bush not consulting them on too many issues. And also there was this feeling that he will be gone soon and there will be a new president. And there was this kind of appeasement feeling to Putin. And Putin, in the meantime, he had a lot of opportunities to buy influence, make friends again in Europe with energy deals and buy his influence in the American and European system. And have no doubt he did it from February 2007 onwards very actively. So he reaped the reward already in April 2008 because Sarkozy and Merkel, they opposed the NATO membership of Ukraine and Georgia in April 2008, and we immediately had the full escalation in August 2008 with the Russian invasion of Georgia and this terrible summer war of the two regions were then military occupied by the Russians in 2008. So Bucharest led directly to this Russian invasion just 3 months later. Appeasement leads to war. That's the logic of aggressor nations. And this is exactly what happened. And then, of course, you know, what was the response of President Obama and Hillary Clinton in 2009? A reset of relations. Obviously, it was also the case that Putin was no longer the president, but the prime minister. And so there was, in a way, a kind of an effort on both sides to reset, but already on the condition that the Ukrainian Orange Revolution was sacrificed. In 2010, it was Yanukovych back in power, and the Georgian occupation and the attached war crimes and everything was reality. So it was a reset on the costs of free Ukraine and free Georgia. And it's a very sad thing. You have big powers somehow find a new relation, a new friendship, a new understanding on the costs of all the smaller powers in between who are unable to protest, but sadly standing on the side and seeing that their destiny is decided by Moscow and Washington above their heads. And this is exactly what happened in Bucharest and then in the years 2010, when Ukraine had to endure another 3.5 years of terrible kleptocracy. The Russian system basically completely extended towards Ukraine again, and it was really a massive loss, as we now know, 40 billion stolen by Yanukovych and his cronies in these terrible years. So that's the consequence of the Bucharest summit. Ultimately, also, obviously, the Bucharest summit defeat debacle has led to the Ukraine war in 2014, because the Ukrainians really didn't want to live under this kleptocracy. Man, who wants? And then they started to protest. They had the opportunity with a trade agreement with Europe, which even Yanukovych promised them in the beginning. But he was already totally default and bankrupt because of his kleptocracy and his currency manipulation. And so he had to look for this massive loan. Then Putin had the leverage to get him not to sign this agreement. So the escalation came. And then close to a real armed revolution, in a sense, with the violence Yanukovych and the exploit used against the Euromaidan and all these tragic events of February 2014. And then his flight. He now lives off his spoils safely somewhere in Moscow. And we are in this mess because of the Bucharest summit and the European appeasement. It's quite logically so many people die when you appease a dictator. And so that was the Bucharest summit, the Munich summit. I have talked about it. And then you see in the logic events, obviously, also a weaker West then, because then exactly after the Bucharest summit, after the Georgia war, came the great financial crisis. Obviously, that was the focus of all decision makers in the world for the years 2008, 2009, 2010, and then 2011 added also the European domestic currency crisis and the debt crisis, especially of Greece, but also Spain, also Italy, also Portugal. And so the whole European framework seemed shaken and was a bit shaken, actually. It was never always totally clear how this will be working out. And obviously Russia buying influence, promising energy deals, picking off one European leader by the next. Orban is the best example, because what you do in this crisis is you buy friends. And, you know, in the crisis, everybody focuses on its own survival, more or less. And then Russia comes with all these amazing energy deals, which promise the population cheaper energy. And also you get something as a prime minister. And then you sign up one by one. And so Orban did exactly that. And other prime ministers, I'm sure, as well. But Orban is the most famous and the clearest cut case to prove it. And with impunity, you can call him a Russian ally in everything but the name. Obviously, he's in NATO and the EU. But the way he behaves, especially since 2013-14, is clearly as if he would be the prime minister of the Hungarian Oblast of the Russian Federation. So beyond that, obviously, we have to see that the developments in Romania especially have also not helped the reputation of EU enlargement. I declare their obvious success, and when you see that Romania is now richer than Argentina and is now really economically very strong, institutionally, obviously, it happened that the socialists regained power. I'm confident with Russian support. And then it happened also that they were also totally corrupt and there was a lot of government changes, a lot of crisis. The people made a lot of protest, but they had this grip on power until recently. And it, of course, has also led to a massive problem for the EU enlargement of the new countries. Because when the existing enlargement countries, the welcoming countries, the new countries, turn out to be so corrupt in dealing with, or perceived so corrupt, and in the Romanian case also to be very corrupt, then you have to do additional measures like CVM, like this kind of control and verification mechanism. And of course, the reputation of enlargement is hurt. It is hurt. And this we have to rebuild with facts and also with reforms and with full integration of Romania, Bulgaria and Croatia in Schengen, in the Eurozone, and with more supervision if necessary, and also with bigger progress and the institutions we need in Europe, like an agency against corruption, like a stronger prosecutor office, to really have the tools on the European level to intervene when things are wrong in new member states and in old member states, by the way. Again, we need to be a more united European Union with all the tools required, like in a state union, to make sure that especially in the case of political collusion with corrupt networks inside the civil administration or the mafia-style business links and collusion, state companies which are controlled by political networks, happens in a lot of countries, actually, also in Austria, that you really have the tools on the European level to intervene hard, decisively, like the Americans have it with the Federal Trade Commission, with the FBI, and with the all other institutions they have already developed over the long history of American unification, and which we need as well, because we are just at the start of being a big state union, which we ultimately will be. So, what happened? There were also positive developments. Obviously, they were the positive. You know, it's great that Romania, Croatia, Bulgaria are member. It's great we are 28. But obviously, we had this big setback of the financial crisis, of the reality, especially of Romanian socialism. But also then we had this big setback in 2016, obviously, with the pending referendum of Brexit, which paralyzed the European Union for quite a period. And then obviously, you know, then, you know, when you want to find a problem which could have negative impact on and the UK referendum, obviously, you have also then the always no consensus for enlargement, because everybody says, Romania was like this and so. And don't forget, there was also at the same time the big catastrophe, which I've talked already from 2011, the Syrian civil war, the massive refugee crisis, also supported by our losing Turkey as a full ally, unfortunately, with Russia intervening also to break Turkey away from the NATO and the EU, and partly succeeding in some aspects, and also Russia intervening heavily in Syria, driving all the refugees out of Syria and making sure they pass towards the European Union, and also destabilizing Europe with this massive influx of refugees, which obviously we should help in a crisis, and I was very much for helping, but obviously it was a big impact on the political system, so enlargement was really not on the table then in 2015, 14, 15, 16, the triple strikes of Ukraine, war, Crimea annexation, escalation in Donbass, then escalation of the Syrian civil war, all these terrible places, the terrible withdrawal of the West from August 2013 and the Ghouta chemical attacks, then this Idlib bombing by the Russians and Aleppo disaster, and then 2015 the massive exodus and the walking, the big walk into the European Union, the big march, and obviously they attached an. You have to understand also that the Russians significantly gave media time and money to all these populist parties in the European Union. The rise of the AfD, certainly something Russia can be very proud about. They facilitated, they supported it, they funded it significantly. I'm confident about that. And also they hope that this kind of supporting the traditional left-wing parties and these new right-wing parties is somehow squeezing European decision makers in less and less ability to react. And that was basically also the case in some period from 2014, especially shell-shocked from Ukraine, and then all these additional crises leading ultimately to Brexit, to the first time we tragically lost the country, and then also to the election of Trump, also heavily supported by this long-term strategy of Russia to turn around the GOP, the most Cold War party, the party that, that won the Cold War and has supported NATO enlargement most of the previous 90s and 2000s. And the Russians have managed, or at least significantly made inroads to turn around the GOP. Never forget, Romney in 2012 was still the president candidate from the GOP, very hostile and very clear to confront Russia, understanding the hostility. Obama was there, the soft guy. And then afterwards, after 2012, the massive intervention in the GOP by Russia to turn around the GOP foreign policy and to have a massive effect. And this is ultimately leading to this big debacle of Trump. So Eastern European future, very much the reason for this Trump presidency and this kind of Cold War playing very much out in the American electoral battlefield of 2016 until 2020. There's no doubt about it. Also, the impeachment was about Ukraine. Let's not forget it. So Ukraine, Manafort was basically the man bringing up Yanukovych in 2010 on behalf of Russian interests. And he again, the chairman of the GOP campaign for Trump, and also then jailed and convicted for all his crimes and then pardoned by Trump now recently in December 2020. Anyhow, that's the context. And let me make it sure that you see as well when America retreats, you have no support for enlargement anymore, because this big American retreat started exactly in August 2013, already in 2008 with the Bucharest Summit, but the highlight was 2013, and since then no single new country has joined the European Union. And the lead nation in Europe in the crisis is from 2013 is of course France, and France has blocked all enlargement ever since. We have no new country in the European Union. And with the three countries which are into consideration, it's of course the NATO allies, Albania, Macedonia, and North Macedonia and Montenegro. And they have become NATO allies in the case of Albania in 2009. But no chance for Albania to join with Croatia in 2013. No, because America was too weak to help its ally. And obviously then it was Montenegro in 2017 coming NATO member, and Macedonia in 2020. So these three countries should be in the front line, but they are not. The real front runner, as it calls in Brussels terms, is of course Serbia, because Serbia is a traditionally long-term ally of France, and France sees the world in World War I dimensions, unfortunately, or pre-World War I alliance system, which is totally wrong in the 2020s, and it doesn't see the world in American-backed NATO, but in this kind of own perceptions of historic allegiances towards France, yeah? Which of course Serbia has. And then Serbia is the front runner, despite Serbia being completely pro-Russian, making treaties with the Russian-backed CSDO, with the Russian-backed Eurasian unions, and buying weapons from Russia, and so on, and so on, and so on, blocking Bosnia's NATO future, not recognizing Kosovo. So the list of Russian non-alliance with EU principles and ideas is so long, still it's the front runner. While the allies, Albania, North Macedonia, Montenegro, are under the next level, or maybe, let's see. Because why? Because ultimately, always when America retreats, then Germany looks for France support in order to have some other big partner. France is, of course, then the big boy in the club, because they always want something and they have this attitude. And then Germany tries to appease France, and Russia has anyhow this opposition to all these enlargements. And then France tries to build a new bridge to Moscow, and the Balkan is sacrificed and the alliance is weakened. And that's the result of the great withdrawal of America since 2013, no new country. And then even the accession start of this kind of Macedonia and Albania is blocked by France. That was the latest escalation of 2019. Yeah? And you see how it is. And there will be no chance for these countries without American leadership and without America and Germany building a strong alliance again, now with President Biden. And basically, it's up to America again to do this. If you believe in NATO, get your allies into the European Union. And this is the way to do it. And these are great allies, these are small allies, obviously, small countries, but they are on this fragile place between Greece and the Balkans, between the East and the West. They very much matter. And they have been reliable allies and the whole time now, and since the end of the Cold War. So please, America, here are the free allies, and bring them in the European Union. The European Union alone will never have the wisdom, generosity, solidarity to make it happen in any foreseeable time. Russia will always massively oppose it. And we are much too divided to get things done of this significance. So you got America, you got Greece into the European Union, Spain, Portugal, Western Germany, England, Denmark, Ireland, Sweden, Finland, Austria. It's your Europe. It's the American Europe. So please, America, make sure that Albania, North Macedonia, Montenegro, they can join already in this mandate. They are certainly much more prepared than any other country in the recent history which joined. Economically, they are well developed now, on the same level like Bulgaria and Croatia were at their accession, or better even than Greece was at their accession. And it's absolutely necessary. If you leave Emmanuel Macron to make this big decision, he will postpone it as long as he's president in the Gaulian manner and will feel kind of vindicated by history even. Yeah? And these countries will not develop better. Postponement means delay in progress. And it's not that outside they will be like ballerinas preparing and repairing themselves wonderfully. No, only inside there is this major cohesion policy and also the regulatory framework, which is firm. So this is the way. Please make sure that Albania and North Macedonia and also Montenegro. Montenegro already the most developed. It's already at the GDP level of Bulgaria. So please, these three countries must join now very much. And nobody should reject them in any decisions. They are ready for membership and they can be easily a EU of 30. It's also very good for the EU. It shows the world. We are ready to manage. We are ready to be attractive. We are ready to enlarge. And we don't need a new Maastricht Treaty or a new big treaty for any of that. That can be done click, click, click. It's all ready. It just needs the political will. And then in 2024, with a new parliament, they can vote already. And then we can do a new treaty also to make sure that Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia, Serbia, Kosovo, and Bosnia can join the European Union once they have joined NATO in 2024, which is necessary prior NATO membership and then EU membership. Good. That's, I think, the clarity on this period, how we became from 25 to 28 and what to do next. And doing the next and good thing I will do in the next podcast, because we have reached half an hour. I want to thank you very much for your attention and support EU enlargement, please, and NATO enlargement. Thanks a lot.